It is gone! A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins into the second deck for Bryce Harper. Drag and a miss. He got him. And Aaron Nola leads two. Segura on the run. Reaches up and makes the grab.
Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 353. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter, at John Stolness. Coming up, lots to get to on the podcast. Going to be joined by MLB.com StatCast guru Mike Petriello in a few minutes. We're going to talk about the Hall of Fame, the Astros cheating scandal, little Nolan Arenado, and his thoughts on the Phillies offseason thus far. We'll dive deep into some former Phillies who look into what moves they made on the Hall of Fame balloting, and one Philly who surprisingly dropped off after 1 year. Get into some NL East news. The Phillies also made a couple of moves on Tuesday and Wednesday, and Baseball America is out with their top 100 prospects. We'll tell you which Phillies made Baseball America's top 100. But before we get into all that, I want to remind you guys to please check out the Hittin' Season Patreon. We got a brand new podcast up there that Justin Clue and Chris Jones just put up there, so make sure you check that out. That's only for our Patreon members who subscribe on the $5 a month tier. If you didn't hear the first show that those guys did on the Patreon, make sure you check this one out. Those guys are hysterical. It's highly entertaining, great Phillies content, and it's bonus content just for Patreon listeners. So again, go to patreon.com/hittinseason to get that. And we also have a lot of other bonus material that we throw up there as well. Videos, different podcasts, some written content as well. And don't forget to tell your friends about the Good Fight podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, wherever it is you get your podcast. All right, let's dip into some Phillies news and notes here as we start off episode 353. The Phillies made four minor league deals with guys. All four of these guys could be on the team here in 2020. We'll start off with Neil Walker, 34-year-old, played 115 games for Miami last year, hit 261, 344, only a 395 slugging percentage with 19 doubles and 8 home runs. He plays first, he plays second, he plays third base. He'd be a bench guy. He also played the two corner outfield spots in 2018 as well. He was very good off the bench last year. In 40 plate appearances as a sub, he hit 324, 425, 588 for a 1,013 OPS, and he had two pinch hit home runs. So if he does make this team, it'll be as a bench bat, and that is where he excelled last year. And kind of looking at the bench right now, they are going to have either five or six bench spots available. Remember, the active roster is now going to be 26 as opposed to 25 men, and it'll just depend on whether or not the Phillies continue to go with eight bullpen arms or whether they go to seven bullpen arms. My guess is they go to eight because now you have that 26th roster spot. You can have five bench players and eight bullpen guys. My guess is that's what they'll end up doing. And so you have Jay Bruce, who's almost certainly going to be on the bench. Roman Quinn, when healthy, will also be on the bench. So that's two spots for sure that are taken up, and both outfielders. And you've got Nick Williams still in the mix. Will Williams play in AAA, or will he be a bench guy? That would be Jay Bruce and Nick Williams as left-handed outfield-only bench guys. Both those guys can only play the corner outfield positions. Those guys seem redundant. I'm not sure how Nick Williams and Jay Bruce are on the bench at the same time. Then you've got a bunch of guys who could potentially fill in the infield. Josh Harrison, there's Brad Miller, Nick Martini, Phil Gosselin, and Neil Walker all in the mix. Andrew Knapp is most likely going to be the backup catcher, although they did sign Bethancourt a couple of weeks ago to a minor league deal as well. All those guys will be in spring training battling it out for probably five spots on the bench with the 26-man active roster and an 8-person bullpen. Another minor league deal the Phillies agreed to on Wednesday was with Francisco Liriano, the former starter and now turned relief pitcher. Pitched for the Pirates last year. He gives the Phillies another left-handed option in the pen to go along with Adam Morgan and with Jose Alvarez, two good left-handed options provided Morgan's healthy. Liriano was pretty good last year, had a 3.47 ERA in 69 appearances with an ERA plus of 123. He does have an issue with walks. He walked 4.5 batters per nine last year, has walked 4 batters per nine on average throughout his career. career. However, he was very good against left-handers last season. Struck out 25% of them versus just 19% of right-handers, but he also walked more left-handers, nearly 15% versus 10.3%. Lefties hit 194 against him last year with a 326 on base and only a 333 slugging. Right-handers hit 246 with a 329 401. So he's not a loogie. He can get right-handers out, although he excels with left-handers. But remember, you're dealing now with a new rule that a relief pitcher has to pitch to at least three batters when they come into the game. So no more lefty-on-lefty matchup, then bringing in the righty, then bringing in the lefty. Adam Morgan and Jose Alvarez also can get right-handers out, although they are more susceptible to right-handed hitters. They don't get lit up by right-handers, and Liriano's the same way. So these are three left-handers who you could potentially use in a lefty-righty-lefty combo. You probably wouldn't want to use them righty-lefty-righty, but you want to minimize their exposure to right-handers. But I like this signing by the Phillies. I think Liriano has a track record. He was very good last year. I'm quite surprised he didn't get a major league deal with someone. It's a $1.5 million minor league deal. So I mean, if he comes up to the majors, it'll cost him $1.5 million, and I think he's going to make the team. I'd be very surprised if Liriano is not in the bullpen when the Phillies break camp from Clearwater. And as our very own Alex Carr noted, with the Neil Walker and Liriano signings here, the Phillies have now have four members of the 2013 Pirates coming to spring training, Andrew McCutchen and Josh Harrison to go along with Neil Walker and Francisco Liriano. A third major leaguer that the Phillies have signed to a minor league deal is relief pitcher Drew Storen. Again, the Phillies just trying to play the lottery here and hoping that Storen can return to something close to the form that he showed from 2010 to 2015. When he had a 3.02 ERA in 355 appearances. Most of those appearances were as a late-inning setup guy or as the Washington Nationals closer. His time in D.C. did not end well. He got beat up pretty good in the 2012 National League Division Series against the Cardinals. The Nats were three out away from moving on to the NLCS in Game 5 of that series, but he gave up four runs in the ninth in an eventual 7-5 loss. He did come back and manage to save a number of games in the 2015 season, 29 saves with a 3.44 ERA, but the Nationals had no confidence in Drew Storen, and that's when they swung the Nick Pivetta for Jonathan Papelbon trade with the Phillies. Papelbon became the Nationals' closer. The team tanked in the last couple months of the 2015 season, and Drew Storen, really, that's the last time he was effective. Since then, he put up a 5.23 ERA for the Blue Jays and Mariners in 2016, had a 4.45 ERA in 2017 for the Reds, and then he suffered an elbow injury, needed Tommy John surgery. He did not pitch at all in 2018, and then came back to throw 10 innings in Double-A last year and was awful with a 7.84 ERA in only 9 appearances. So it was a small sample size. He was coming off of Tommy John surgery. Obviously, the Phillies, they're not guaranteeing this guy a spot. I don't feel good about Drew Storen becoming a member of this bullpen. I don't think it's going to happen, but it's a lottery ticket. You're hoping that the Tommy John surgery helped, that a full offseason to recover and get ready for the season will make him a different pitcher than what we saw at the tail end of 2019. The last minor league pitcher the Phillies signed this week is Bud Norris. He's been around since 2009. He did not pitch at all last year, but he wasn't injured. He didn't have Tommy John surgery. He just wasn't able to latch on with the team. In 2018, it's kind of surprising because in 2018, he had a 3.59 ERA in 64 games for the Cardinals and piled up 28 saves. The 34-year-old righty posted some solid numbers in 2017 and 18 with the Angels and Cardinals in those two combined seasons, had a combined 3.91 ERA with a 3.94 FIP, which shows you that ERA was deserved. 141 strikeouts against 48 walks in 119 and two-thirds innings. So of all of these players, of all of these names, the guys I feel most confident of making this team are Neil Walker, Francisco Liriano, and Bud Norris. Drew Storen, to me, is the guy I think has maybe the best upside of the three relief pitchers, but I'm also the least confident that he's going to be able to do anything. Now, I know, Phillies fans, none of these moves excite you. None of these moves are going to get you are going to make you thrilled. You want the Phillies to go past the luxury tax. I wanted to go to the Phillies to go past the luxury tax, but we're beyond that point now because there's nothing out there worth getting that to put you over the luxury tax. And looking at how the Phillies are going about trying to build their bullpen for 2020, given the problems that they had with David Robertson and the injury and all the money that they gave him, how much money they're just flushing down the toilet as he undergoes Tommy John surgery, how much money they were paying Pat Nashak last year to give them nothing, how much money they gave Tommy Hunter last year to give them nothing, how much money they gave Juan Nicasio last year to be highly ineffective, you can understand in a very weak relief pitcher market why they didn't go after some of these guys. Let me just run down the list of free agent relief pitchers, how much they signed for. Will Smith, a 30-year-old pitcher, got a 3-year, $40 million deal with the Atlanta Braves, $13.3 million a season. Drew Pomeranz, 31-year-old. I love Drew Pomeranz. Would have loved to have gotten him for a 4-year deal. 4-year, $34 million deal, $8.5 million a year to San Diego. That's a big price tag for a guy you don't know he's going to be great moving forward. 35-year-old Will Harris got a 3-year deal, $24 million, $8 million a season to go to the Nationals. Daniel Hudson re-signs with the Nationals for a good deal. I would have signed Hudson for 2 years and $11 million at $5.5 average annual value, but he wanted to go back to Washington. Dellin Betances, a 1-year deal, that's great, but $10.5 million. If he's effective, it's a steal. If he's not effective, that's a lot of money to be thrown down the toilet, but the New York Mets gave him $10.5 million. Blake Treinen, 32 years old, signed a 1-year $10 million deal with the Dodgers. Craig Stammen, 36 years old, signed a 2-year $9 million deal with the Padres. Joe Smith, also 36, a 2-year $8 million deal with Houston. Jake Diekman, Steve Cishek, Sergio Romo, all signed deals that were relatively inexpensive. Diekman's was a 2-year deal, Cishek and Romo 1 year each. But are any of those guys substantially better than Francisco Liriano? I mean, would you rather have Jake Diekman at $3.75 million a year, $3.75 million a year, or Francisco Liriano at 1 year for $1.5 million? I'll take Liriano over Diekman in that case. Cishek and Romo, they probably would be. They're definitely safer options than Bud Norris and Drew Storen, but am I convinced that 34-year-old Steve Cishek and 37-year-old Sergio Romo is going to be worth $5 million a season, $6 million next year? I'm not. There was no top end of the class. There was no top end, top flight closer to go out and get. And the Phillies were burned last year in going out and getting older relief pitchers and spending a lot of money to do so. So I kind of understand what they're doing here with the bullpen. And like I've said on previous podcasts, the bullpen is one of the easiest things in the world to go fix after the fact. Once the season starts, the Nationals did it last year. Other teams have done it. You can rebuild your bullpen in midstream during the course of the regular season, and that's probably what the Phillies are going to have to do. And you know what? Listen, with these guys, with Neil Walker, Francisco Liriano, Drew Storen, Bud Norris, you need some of these moves to work out if you're going to be a contender. How many of these types of players have we seen the Braves get mileage out of? I mean, Nick Markakis, chief among them. But you saw the Nationals get mileage out of Asdrubal Cabrera and Howie Kendrick. You've seen, and frankly, with Daniel Hudson, guys like that, you've seen teams, successful teams, you need guys like this, cheap guys that you bring in hoping they give you something. You need some of these to hit. You got to hit on one or two of these to help your bench, to help the back of your bullpen, to help the middle innings of your bullpen. The Phillies bench last year was awful, and if Neil Walker can provide them some help, that's a big deal. You need a good bench in order to succeed in big league baseball nowadays. And so I'm fine with these minor league deals. They're not designed to wow you, but hopefully they're designed to, hopefully at the end of the season you're thinking, man, where would we have been without Bud Norris? Man, where would we have been without Neil Walker? That dude had some huge hits for us this year. Where would we be without Francisco Liriano stepping up in a couple of July and August games when our bullpen was shot? And we needed Liriano to give us 2 innings in the 7th and 8th inning, and he came through for us. You need guys like that to perform in the playoffs when you get there and to step up and give you key innings here and there. And so the Phillies haven't had that. They haven't hit on those types of players. they got to get some of those to work out if they're going to be good in 2020. So I have no problem with a lot of those moves. Let's also dip into some stuff about the National League East here this week. The Braves got themselves a pretty good hitter. They went out and got Marcell Ozuna, the former Cardinals outfielder, signed him to a one-year, $18 million deal. He'll play left field for the Atlanta Braves this year. He'll probably supplant Nick Markakis, although my guess is Markakis will get some at-bats against some tough right-handed pitching. Ozuna is still just 29 years old. He hit .241, but hit 29 home runs and 89 RBIs last season with St. Louis. He's a two-time All-Star who spent his first five seasons with the Marlins and then was traded and played 2 years in St. Louis. Last year, he was worth 2.2 wins above replacement, according to Baseball Reference. That's three wins less than Donaldson. So they are not replacing Donaldson win for win, but they are probably getting more. I think Keith Law from The Athletic put it at about one win above replacement more with Ozuna as opposed to what would have been in left field. So they're upgrading a little bit in left field, but they still have that big hole at third base. But that's going to be a good bat for them in the middle of the lineup. He doesn't scare me, but it's definitely something the Braves needed to do, is to go out and get another bat, a right-handed bat, to help out, to drive in some runs in the middle of that lineup. And he had some shoulder issues that he was dealing with. It affected his defense, his throwing. It also appeared to hurt his ability to swing the bat as well, because he wasn't nearly as aggressive as he normally is. So I think it's a nice move for Atlanta. As a Phillies fan, I'm not happy that they went out and made that move, but nor does it terrify me that Marcell Ozuna is a member of the Atlanta Braves moving forward. Frankly, Nick Markakis killed the Phillies as much as Marcell Ozuna possibly could. So even if Marcell Ozuna gives them what Markakis did, it's not going to make any difference as far as the Phillies are concerned. One other piece of news. The New York Mets have quickly replaced Carlos Beltran with Luis Rojas as their next manager. Mets quality control coach was hired last year to be the team's first ever quality control coach under former manager Mickey Callaway. And he, of course, replaces Beltran, who was fired after Beltran was named in Major League Baseball's cheating scandal. Rojas's father is Felipe Alou, which it's interesting. Rojas has a different last name than Alou, but his actual last name is Alou. It's just there was, I read a story, I forget who wrote the story. I think it was with MLB.com, so forgive me. Whoever wrote the story last year profiling Luis Rojas, it was a very good piece. But there was some kind of an issue with the surnames and translating that information into his American documents when he came over here. And so he has a different name than Felipe Alou, but Luis Rojas is the son of former Expos and Giants manager Felipe Alou. And he has some managerial experience. From 2017 to 18, he managed at AA Binghamton, where he led them to a playoff berth in 2017. He managed rookie ball in 2011. He managed three seasons of Class A ball, Class A advanced ball. He was a manager when Pete Alonso was coming through the system, Jeff McNeil, Dominic Smith, Ahmed Rosario, Brandon Nimmo, Thomas Nito, all among the Mets players who were under his watch at some point during his time as manager of these younger teams. His brother is Moises Alou. He said that Rojas is a modern guy who loves statistics and analytics. He draws praise for his communication abilities. This is a guy who I think has that analytic background that a lot of teams want, much in the same way that Mickey Callaway did. I love the fact that the Mets went out and hired a Hispanic to manage the team. There's not enough minority hiring in these positions in Major League Baseball, and so it's a really good move. And I mentioned Keith Law just a second ago. I think I'm mentioning him because I saw a couple of things that he mentioned on Twitter today. And he made the joke on Twitter that the Mets have inadvertently hired a highly qualified manager. So not great news for the Phillies, but good news for the Mets. It looks like they went out and replaced Carlos Beltran with someone who absolutely deserves a shot. So I'm not wishing Luis Rojas good luck professionally, because that means, generally speaking, he'll be beating the Phillies a lot. But it sure seems like that they've taken a chance on another first-year guy. It's what the Mets seem to want to do. And most of what I've seen, it's been positively reviewed. So this might be this whole Carlos Beltran thing. Maybe it's a blessing in disguise for the Mets. I mean, As much as I don't like that organization, they are due to have something good happen to them at some point. Well, up next, we're going to talk to Mike Petriello from MLB.com. We're going to get his thoughts on a whole range of things. That's up next here on Hittin' Season. Well, it's been a pretty interesting offseason here so far. We've got cheating scandals to talk about. We've got Nolan Arenado to talk about. We've got the Hall of Fame to talk about and a little bit of Phillies to talk about here with Mike Petriello from MLB.com, StatCast guru. You can follow him on Twitter at Mike_Petriello. Mike, welcome back to Hittin' Season. How are you, man?
John, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
It's awesome to have you back. It's been a little while. I think last time we had John was last summer, so it's always good to chat with you. And we've got a lot to talk about because we've got the Hall of Fame announcement from yesterday. I'm kind of surprised that Larry Walker got in. I want to talk to you about him in just a second. But first, we'll start off with Derek Jeter because, you know, there's been a million think pieces and there's been a million profiles and feature pieces on Derek Jeter. And that always happens when a first ballot Hall of Famer gets voted in. One vote short of unanimous, though. I really thought he was going to join Mariano Rivera as two unanimous selections in a row. Are you surprised that there was one holdout who said, nah?
I'm a little surprised. There's certainly a part of me that's a little, I don't know, happy's not the right word, but I sort of enjoy this a little more than I would have had he just been unanimous.
Yeah, you know? Curious.
The whole thing is so stupid, honestly, right? Like, if you go back to the beginning, the reasons that some of, like, the all-time inner circle legends, like Ted Williams and Willie Mays, like, they didn't get it for just, like, the stupidest possible reasons, and this one's pretty dumb, too. I don't necessarily care who did it. Like, right now, we don't know, which is kind of silly to hear people saying, oh, this person did it for attention, which is tough to do when you're anonymous. Mm-hmm. I don't even care who did it because that person will just get, like, harassed to the end of time. But I'd love to know why. I'd love to know, did they not think he was a Hall of Famer, which is insane? Did they think that there were 12 guys they wanted and they had to leave someone off, which is defensible? Was it actually just a mistake? Like, did you forget to mark his name off? Like, there's so many reasons it could be. I would love to know why. That's all I care about. And I'm not sure we're ever actually going to find out.
Yeah, no, I don't think so either. And I know there's that old school baseball writer's mentality of you never vote someone in their first year on the ballot. But that didn't hold true last year with Rivera. And I'd be very curious to hear the rationale from someone, if it was on purpose. Like you mentioned, it could have been accidental. But the rationale for a person who, if this person voted for Mariano Rivera last year and didn't vote for Derek Jeter this year, I'd be fascinated to hear the reason why, but I don't think we're ever going to hear that.
No, me neither. I'd love to know that this was the guy who voted for, like, J.J. Putz, too, by the way. That would really make him, like, an American hero.
That would be great. And I think the turnaround for Larry Walker these last few years has been amazing. It didn't look like he had a chance a couple of years ago, and these last 2 years have seen an incredible turnaround. I know that for a lot of voters, that Colorado Rockies stigma playing in Coors Field gets attached to them. But thankfully, in this case, it didn't happen to Larry Walker. How good was he and how deserving was he of getting into the Hall of Fame?
I felt him deserving. You're right about the way he's really ascended here. I don't have the article in front of me, but I think I read from Jay Jaffe or somebody that he came from the furthest back. Like, he was a low of like 10% 1 year, and nobody ever got in had started from that low.
Right. I think it was the biggest increase over a 4 year period ever.
Yeah, which is really cool. What was interesting to me is, like, as you mentioned, Coors Field, right? And everybody, you know, talks about Coors Field and are the numbers inflated, and certainly that's a talking point here. What I found kind of fascinating is I was at MLB Network last week, and I was on a show with John Smoltz and Mike Lowell, and then Peter Gammons, who also left Walker off his ballot, kind of mentioned this as well. And none of the three of them really talked about Coors Field so much. They all kind of talked more about games played and durability and the ability to, you know, post, as they like to call it, which I thought was really interesting. It's not an unfair thing to talk about because certainly he missed a lot of games, but it was fascinating to me that it wasn't just about Coors Field in a lot of minds. And, you know, the Coors Field thing is very easy to get past. He played 70% of his games away from Coors Field. If you go back to his monster 1997 MVP season, he was better away from Coors Field. You know, certainly the ballpark inflated the batting average, added some RBIs. Like, nobody argues with that. But it's kind of fun to see it wasn't just that. The games played thing really stuck in a lot of people's minds. And I thought he was going to miss. Once you saw some guys have a Jeter-only ballot and you saw Gannon's drop him for some reason, I thought he was going to miss by like two, and that was going to be terrible. And really, it's been such a weird and in some cases bad offseason for us to all be gifted with the sight of Larry Walker in a SpongeBob t-shirt accepting his induction. That was a very fun and cool moment.
Yeah, the video is online if anybody hasn't seen it. It was surrounded by family and stuff. That was a very, very cool moment for a guy in his last year of eligibility. It would have been if he had missed, it would have been so razor close. He probably would have got in on a Veterans Committee vote in a few years. But, you know, it's certainly special to get voted in by the writers and your last year on the ballot. Just very, very cool to see Larry Walker get in. So keeping in the Colorado theme, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what the Rockies are doing with Nolan Arenado right now. I mean, it seems for all the world like there's a divorce coming between these two sides. What are the Rockies thinking, Mike?
I don't know. Does anybody know? No. Does literally anybody know?
No.
There are some echoes of what happened on the left side of their infield like 5 years ago, right, where they had Troy Tulowitzki, who was at the time, you know, their franchise player and signed to a big deal. And then he got dealt to Toronto in what was kind of an acrimonious split. Like, he did not have a lot of nice things to say on the way out the door. You know?
Yeah.
And that deal didn't end up working out very well. Obviously, that Jose Reyes situation and Jeff Hossman has never really blossomed. And this is sort of reminiscent of that, but it's also a little bit weirder because I think, you know, Arenado, he's a future Hall of Famer in my book. I don't know that we ever thought that about Tulowitzki.
No.
But Arenado for sure. And he only just signed this, you know, long-term deal like 11 months ago. It's crazy to think we've gotten from there to here. And I've seen some fans kind of pushing back on him a little bit, saying like, listen, you just signed the deal. You just took all their money. You just agreed to stay there. You can't complain now. Well, I understand where they're coming from. I disagree with that. Certainly, number one, first and foremost, he's earned the money. Like, he is a great player.
Yeah.
But also, it seems like they made him some promises that they would continue trying to improve to get him back to the playoffs. I think he's only been there twice, maybe, and they haven't gone very far either time.
Mm-hmm.
And that last year they lost 91 games. They lost 91 games while having a great season from Arenado and a great season from Trevor Story and a pretty good season from Charlie Blackman. And so far they've added, I think, nobody, almost literally nobody. They seem to have their plan being to roll it back and hope things go better. And I'm willing to, like, agree that maybe Kyle Freeland isn't as much of a mess as he was in 2019, but I also don't think he was as good as he was in 2018. Like, you can't just stand pat, add nothing, and think things are going to get better. So I understand his frustration there. And then what I can't really comment on specifically because I just don't know anything about it is, in some of the quotes from him, it certainly seemed like there's a personal issue between him and the general manager, Jeff Breidich. You know, he mentioned him by name. I can't speculate on what that is. I have no idea. But certainly it does seem like a bad situation. And since he holds all the cards, he's got the opt-out and a no-trade. I don't know if it's going to happen before opening day because it's not that far away and it's really hard to see a deal that makes sense for Colorado, but this is not a situation that seems like it's going to work itself out.
Yeah, that opt-out is in 2 years, and the full no-trade clause, certainly it's reminiscent of the Giancarlo Stanton divorce from the Marlins at one point, and for Phillies fans, the Scott Rolen divorce from the Phillies back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. With Arenado, I think it's – I wonder how much – him being on the trade block is part of what he was talking about with him. He mentioned in his text to MLB.com disrespect twice. And I wonder how much of the fact that he was on the trade block in the first place is playing into this.
You could see that. It's certainly the fact that they didn't move to squash those rumors like immediately 2 months ago might have bothered him.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's entirely that because of the timing of this. Like, earlier in the day, Jeff Breidich had basically come out and said, we're not trading him. You know, he's going to be opening day at third baseman. And then it was like, I don't know, 90 minutes later, you start hearing about how upset Nolan Arenado is. So it doesn't seem to me that being told you're not going to get traded and then getting upset means he was upset to be on the block. I wonder if he was upset because he'd been left a twist, or maybe he wanted to get traded and he was upset it didn't happen.
I don't know,
but it all sounds bad.
Right, and I think Colorado has really screwed themselves over here because you're right. He doesn't have any trade value left, and I know there's a lot of Phillies fans that would love to see the Phillies go get him, and it's hard to come up with a trade scenario. I mean, I came up with a scenario online that was the Phillies were massively overpaying for Arenado given everything that's been going on, but I don't think Colorado also wants to sell him cheap. I mean, even though he does have this opt-out after 2 years, they could still wait a year. I mean, unless Arenado makes it so uncomfortable for everyone over these next few months that they feel like they have to trade him this summer, the Rockies really aren't under any urgency because I guess, yes, you don't want to necessarily move him when he could become a free agent that following offseason. So you'd probably get a little bit more with 2 years if you give a team 2 years of control. But with everything that's going on, it feels like the Rockies have missed their opportunity to get maximum value for him.
Yeah, it's a really tough trade to make. I think Craig Edwards of Fangraphs outlined this pretty well. You know, between the massive contract itself and the no trade and the opt-out and the fact that the Rockies certainly aren't going to, you know, trade him for peanuts. I mean, you look back at what the Marlins got for Stanton, you know, no disrespect to Starlin Castro, but it wasn't that much. I don't know how the logistics of a trade actually work. You're right, unless Arenado makes things very difficult. I don't know him personally at all, but from his reputation, it seems hard to imagine he would actually do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's tough. Like, they're not going to be good enough to win this year. They've done nothing this winter. They are massively overvaluing their own team, I think, or overestimating their own team. And it's a shame, because if you were to look at, like, you know, the top five players on every team, like just what you'd consider the cores, the Rockies have a pretty decent core.
You know,
like Arenado's a star. Story's a star. I love Herman Marquez.
Yeah, he's a good pitcher.
Pretty decent. And then they've never had any depth. They've always had a top-heavy lineup. They've always, you know, assumed that maybe one day Ian Desmond could hit, and it's not going to happen. They are the fourth best team in that division, and I certainly understand his frustration.
And what's really fascinating is that they did make the playoffs 2 years ago, and you wrote about for MLB.com this week about the Dodgers really just sitting pat this offseason, which is kind of surprising. The Dodgers have a ton of talent to begin with, but the Dodgers haven't done anything this offseason. And you could understand if Colorado saw an opportunity there and decided to push their chips in a little bit more to maybe overtake a Dodgers team that had grown fatigued with coming close and not being able to see the deal. What's going on with Los Angeles that they're not spending money, or that they're not being more aggressive with making trades this offseason?
Yeah, it's a weird situation, and that's what I wrote about. I tried really hard to, like, toe the line between explain what they're doing and not defend a lack of spending. Like, certainly that's not where we want to be in baseball right now. We want the best teams to try to improve, and the Dodgers haven't. So I wasn't trying to defend it so much as explain it. And really what I came down to were, I think, two different things. One is that the division is really, it's weak, right? The Giants are rebuilding. We just talked about the Rockies. The Padres haven't had a winning season in a decade. You know, the Diamondbacks are okay. This isn't a situation like last year where Cleveland did nothing and lost the division. You know, it was really hard for me to see the Dodgers not winning the division for the eighth time in a row. And the second thing was, when you think about the top free agents, I'm more convinced than ever that Steven Strasburg and Anthony Rendon were never, ever going to go there. You know, Strasburg didn't want to leave Washington. We all heard Rendon's comments about the quote-unquote Hollywood lifestyle, however you want to take that. Could they have outbid the Yankees for Gerrit Cole? Maybe, but, you know, what's that, 10 years and $400 million?
Right.
That's tough to get mad at a team for not spending on. So I think what they're saying is, beyond that, there's no one who's a real difference maker. They could have gone for Josh Donaldson. He'd have been a nice fit.
Right.
But what they can do now is safely assume they're going to win the division and see what happens over the next couple months. Because you figure you get to July and you know a little bit more than you know now. You know who's hurt, obviously. You know if gambling on Blake Treinen was a good idea or a bad idea. You know
right.
If Dustin May or Tony Gonsolin or Julio Urias can be relied upon now or not. You know who's available at the trade market. Now, there's risk, obviously, because right now all you need to do is just go throw a ton of money at somebody, and in July you've got to give up prospects and get another team to agree and have guys be available. So there's huge risk that they get to July and there's nobody out there who fits them, and then they are screwed again. But I at least understand. As I tried to explain to someone on Twitter, I do think teams should spend money to try to improve, but it shouldn't be spending for the sake of spending. You know,
right.
Improvement, go make it. I'm not sure there was necessarily that great fit for them right now.
Yeah, and you know, that's kind of interesting with the Phillies too, because they are going to have a payroll over $200 million, and they seem intent on staying under the luxury tax here. And a lot of fans are really upset about the Phillies and their refusal to get a second starting pitcher this offseason and to get bullpen help. I mean, they've signed a couple of relievers to minor league deals, who Drew Storen and Bud Norris. I'm not sure you can count on either of those guys. You can't count on either of those guys to be productive or contribute in a major way. If it happens, great, but despite the fact the Phillies have a payroll of around $200 million, there's still a sense that the team is cheap, or the team's not spending, or they're not doing enough to close the gap between the Braves and the Nationals. And I was wondering what your thought was on the Phillies' offseason this year, whether you feel they've done enough to really close the gap between them and the teams that finished the season in front of them last year.
Yeah, it's a tough division, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to call them cheap after the contract they gave to Zach Wheeler. I mean, that was a pretty large outlay on a guy who it's very clearly betting on projection rather than track record. They as I hardly need to tell you, certainly need some help in the bullpen. You know, they haven't really added anybody, but this is also a really weak market for relievers.
Yeah.
You know, like, if were you going to give a fifth year to Drew Pomeranz? That's a huge...
Probably not.
I mean, yeah. You know, who else? Like, Will Smith, I liked a lot. He seemed like he wanted to go back and play in Georgia, which, you know, it's a little bit of an advantage for the Braves. I don't know that they've closed the gap because I don't know what to make of Didi Gregorius. I like to think he's better than he was last year, where he wasn't very good on either side of the ball. It's just, it's a team with a lot of talent and just so many questions that I have. I don't know if Jake Arrieta is a major league pitcher anymore. You know, I don't know
you and me both.
If Scott Kingery can play third base every day anymore. And I don't know if Rhys Hoskins is a good player or a great player. You know, I don't know what to make of the outfield. Like, I like McCutchen a lot, and obviously I'm probably a bigger Harper fan than a lot of Phillies fans are. Mm. But I'm not sure about center field right now. Clearly nobody wants to see Herrera playing there ever again.
Right.
So have they closed the gap? I don't know. But if there's one thing I'd be maybe moderately optimistic about here, and let me preface this by saying I don't actually think Gabe Kapler was the reason for any of the Phillies' problems last year. I don't think he was a good manager, but none of what happened I don't think was really on him. But when I look at the Phillies' players from last year, I don't think I can look to a single guy and say, you know what, that guy overachieved. You know, that guy gave me more than I thought he would. You know, some guys gave less, but, you know, nobody was, like, really popped. And some of these guys have more talent than that. So you could still look at some of these guys and say, well, I'm going to get that great Kingery year, you know, or Nick Pivetta is finally going to put it all together. And if that happens, people will give credit to Girardi and not Kapler and fine, whatever.
Yeah.
But if you just get one or two of those guys to make that step forward, like, that's what the great teams have done. You know, you look at all the guys the Yankees pulled out of nowhere last year. You know,
yeah,
you look
right.
at the Dodgers pulling up, you know, here comes Chris Taylor. You know, here comes all these guys. The Phillies haven't done that, but they have the talent to do it. So if they can just get one or two of those guys to put it all together, that'll be a huge internal help.
Yeah, I'm very excited to see Kingery in his third year and playing one position. I think he can play all over the field. He can play center field and second base and shortstop and third base, but I'm curious to see if his offense will benefit from staying in one place, at least for most of the season. He might get moved mid-season someplace else, but not moving all over the place, I think, will help him, and he's got a lot of talent. He had a great first half last year, but like a lot of the Phillies players, they had great first halves and poor second halves, or poor first halves and great second halves, and nobody was able to do it all at the same time, and that's something else that I hope kind of straightens out here in 2020, because you never really had five or six guys all playing well at the same time. Let me move over here finally to finish up with the Astros scandal. Players spoke over the weekend, or they said some words. I'm not sure that they actually said much, but they seem to talk about this whole thing as if it was other players who were doing the cheating. I'm talking mostly about Alex Bregman and Jose Altuve, but other players as well. What's your take on how the Astros players have handled and reacted to the scandal in the wake of baseball's report?
How stoked are you if the Astros win this division, which they very well might because they're still very talented, to have everyone talk about it like it's a redemption story,
right?
overcoming tragedy? This whole thing has been, it's been really tough. Like, I did not really like the way that those guys handled that. Just yesterday, the owner said that they would probably come together and have like a group team apology in spring training, which I guess is better than nothing, but I'm not sure that's not just a reaction to the way those guys reacted the other day.
Yeah.
They are never, ever again going to receive the benefit of that on anything, nor should they, obviously. But also, it's so tough to know how to look at these guys going forward. Like, it doesn't matter how much it helped or didn't help. They cheated. They got caught. They deserve all the punishments. But also, I can't look at this team this year and say, well, I don't actually think Alex Bregman is any good because he's not cheating. You know?
Right, right.
A top 10 pick who mashed his way through all professional baseball. I still think he's going to have an MVP caliber season. And I know he'll get questions about it. But it's a bad look that they haven't really handled it very well, and not just related to this. I mean, the whole Brandon Taubman thing and the reaction to that and the way they handled that last October, it hasn't been great. We don't know at this point, while I'm sitting here talking to you, who the GM's going to be or who the manager's going to be. And, you know, certainly some of the names been bandied about would be like a massive shift, not only in culture, but just in terms of, like, this team has always been considered to be super progressive analytically. And, you know, if they get Dusty Baker or somebody, that's not necessarily that
right.
guy.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to watch. I mean, the thing is, they're still really good. I will probably still choose them to be my division winner, or not choose them so much as predict them to be my division winner.
Right.
Because there's so much talent there. And, and that's going to be, it's going to be a weird season overall. And I'm really excited about that Astros-Red Sox ALDS we're going to get. It'll be great.
Yeah, we're still waiting to hear what happens with the Red Sox. That'll be interesting as well. Last thing for you. So what was more damaging to baseball, do you think? Was the PED scandal more damaging, or was this cheating scandal more damaging?
I'm not sure there's a good answer to that question. I think, you know, I don't have a good answer to that.
They're each damaging in their own way, I guess.
Yeah, it's so different now. I mean, certainly there's been some criticism about the way, you know, the commissioner has handled this and not banning any players or anything, but at least they've come down hard on it. You know, like with PEDs, it was a little different. There weren't rules against it at first, and we'll never know who did or didn't do anything. You know, it's hard for anybody, team side or league side or player side, connected to this in any way, coming out looking good. You know, and it's a real shame, because if not for this, we would have been talking, we were talking about the Astros of recent vintage being like up there at the 27 Yankees or whoever else. The Big Red Machine is like the most dominant collection of players of all time. I don't believe that what they did extracurricularly got them to that point. But it doesn't matter, because no one's ever going to look at them the same way again.
Yeah, that's really, and that's their legacy, at least until they can prove otherwise. But interesting stuff. We live in interesting times, as the Eastern philosophers used to say. And Mike Petriello from MLB.com, read his stuff there. Check out the StatCast page, all the great new information they got there. The infield, the outs above average with the infield stuff is very interesting, Mike. All that new data that you guys have put together on that. So make sure you guys check out that stuff. And again, follow Mike on Twitter at Mike_Petriello. Mike, thanks for coming back on Hittin' Season. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean. Take care.
Well, up next, we're going to dip into a little bit more of the Hall of Fame voting, give you my thoughts on some of the former Phillies who are still on the ballot and some who dropped off. And we'll go over Baseball America's top 100 prospects, let you know which Phillies made the list. That's up next here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season. So just to finish up with the Hall of Fame conversation that I started with Mike just a second ago, let's talk about Curt Schilling, let's talk about Scott Rolen, and let's talk about Bobby Abreu, three players who were on the ballot last year, returned this year. And let's start with Curt Schilling, because as I'm looking ahead to next season, the first-timers on the 2021 ballot have absolutely no shot at getting inducted. Tim Hudson leads this class, next year's class. Mark Burley, Torrey Hunter, Dan Haren, Barry Zito, and Aramis Ramirez lead the 2021 Hall of Fame class. None of those guys are coming anywhere close to getting in. There are some former Phillies on next year's ballot for the first time. Shane Victorino makes the Hall of Fame ballot for the first time, along with Grady Sizemore, A.J. Burnett, and Aaron Harang. So I'm going to love to see Shane Victorino up there. We'll get to do some think pieces about the Flying Hawaiian, but, I mean, none of those guys are Hall of Fame worthy. And so this sets things up very well for Curt Schilling. Even with Derek Jeter on everybody's ballot but one, and Larry Walker getting on a bunch of ballots, and you know, you've still got the Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens contingent and all that, Curt Schilling saw another big increase this year, and he was up to 70% of the vote this time around, his eighth year of eligibility. And I've always said with Curt Schilling, if you base his candidacy on his on-the-field stuff, he's a no-doubt Hall of Famer for me. His regular season statistics are pretty good, but when you couple that with his postseason heroics, Curt Schilling absolutely is a Hall of Famer. But there is a lot more to him to consider than that. And it would be really nice if I could, I would love to celebrate a former Philly getting into the Hall of Fame, but his candidacy goes beyond agreeing and disagreeing with his politics. So Schilling has said things and done things that go beyond just supporting President Trump. I mean, most baseball players support President Trump. And whether you support President Trump or don't support President Trump, I don't care as far as this podcast is concerned. I really don't. I keep politics out of this podcast for the most part. I mean, if it's got to be in there, it's got to be in there. But
I don't like or dislike any player because they believe a certain thing politically, but there are some other things with Curt Schilling. Some of the things that he has said about hanging journalists, and he said some other things that would, you know, he's posted things on social media that were intolerant towards minorities and race groups, and said things about, you know, there's a lot of that with Curt Schilling. You all know, you don't need me rehashing everything, and so I totally get not wanting to give Curt Schilling a platform in that case. And no matter where you come down on the Curt Schilling thing, he's so controversial and he's such a lightning rod that it's not going to be a celebration, a joyous thing when he gets inducted into the Hall of Fame. And it will probably happen next year, almost certainly. If not, it'll definitely happen in his final year of eligibility, given how things are going. Normally, when a Philly gets inducted into the Hall of Fame, it's a party. It's a big celebration. And there will no doubt be some Phillies fans who will celebrate it, who will take part in that celebration, but it won't be universal. It won't be a thing that brings us all together. I think that's my main issue with Curt Schilling and making the Hall of Fame. It's not going to be an induction that brings us all together. And that's when a Phillies player makes the Hall of Fame, it kind of does. I mean, the caravan of Phillies fans who went up to see Mike Schmidt get inducted and Richie Ashburn get inducted, those were memorable moments. Steve Carlton, those were memorable moments in Phillies history. And you're just not going to see that. You're just not going to see that with Curt Schilling. It's going to be contentious. There's going to be arguments. There's going to be people upset, rightly so. And there's going to be people on both sides, people who support Curt Schilling and people who don't support Curt Schilling. And that's the thing that's going to really stink about next year's Hall of Fame voting, is that he might be the only person to be inducted, and it's going to be controversial as all hell, and I'm not looking forward to it. Scott Rolen, let's talk a little bit about Scott Rolen. He saw a huge surge this time around, more than any other player who returned from the previous ballot. He was up 18% from 17.2% in 2019 to 35.3% this time around. Again, an 18-point jump from 1 year to the next. Gary Sheffield saw the second highest jump, a 17% increase. Billy Wagner had the third highest jump at 15%. Bobby Abreu just barely stayed on the ballot, getting 5.5%. You need 5% to stay on the ballot for another season. It wasn't looking so good for Bobby to stay on the ballot, but he just barely cleared that minimum 5% number. It'd be nice to see that number go up for him. I don't think Bobby Abreu is a Hall of Famer. He has a lot of really great numbers, but whenever I watched him play, he never seemed like one of the 20 best players in the sport, 25 best players in the sport. He was not a perennial all-star. He won a gold glove here and there, but he was never an MVP candidate. He had some serious flaws in his game. I love Bobby Abreu. I think he gets a bad rap in Philadelphia. He was a great player, but I don't think he's a Hall of Fame player. It is nice to see him stay on the ballot for at least one more season, and he'll probably stick around for a few more years, but especially with the field getting a little bit light in top shelf candidates. But Bobby Abreu just barely stays on the ballot for another season, getting 5.5% of the vote. By the way, his career wins above replacement of 60 is higher than Sammy Sosa, Jeff Kent, and Omar Vizquel, all position players who got more of the vote than he did in 2020. Let's talk a little bit about Cliff Lee. Cliff Lee drops off the ballot after his first year of eligibility. He only received 2 votes, 0.5% of the vote. That's a shame. And Cliff Lee is not a Hall of Famer. His jaws of 41.6 certainly puts him below the number for starting pitchers. And I understand. I would probably not have voted for him this time around either. There were other more deserving candidates, and I think Lee, in another year, next year probably, certainly clears the 5% threshold. This year, there were more candidates that deserved votes than he did. And so only getting 2 votes, it's incredible when you think about the track he was on. And it really makes you realize how hard being a Hall of Fame player is. A guy as good as Cliff Lee was, in a 6-year stretch from 2008 to 2013, that he would only get 0.5% of the Hall of Fame vote in his one and only time on the ballot, just tells you how hard it is to get into the Hall of Fame. Cliff Lee made four All-Star teams, won a Cy Young, finished third in the Cy Young voting in 2011, and went 85-50 between the years 2008 to 2013 with a 2.89 ERA. His 36.8 wins above replacement was best among all major league pitchers during that time. Better than Clayton Kershaw, better than Justin Verlander, better than Felix Hernandez, and better than Roy Halladay. His 2.89 ERA was third lowest. Only Kershaw and Hisashi Iwakuma, who had far fewer innings, had a lower ERA than Cliff Lee in that six-year stretch. He was fifth in innings pitched during that time. He dominated in strikeout-to-walk ratio, a 6.1 strikeout-to-walk ratio during that time. The next closest was Roy Halladay's 4.9. I mean, he was an effective strike-throwing machine. So no, Cliff Lee was not a Hall of Famer, but he should have been able to stick around for more than 1 year on the ballot. And again, I think if next year had been his first year of eligibility, he probably would have. I think he ran into a numbers game this time around. But Cliff Lee, a surprising one and done on the ballot. Some other final thoughts on the Hall of Fame. Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds saw almost no movement from 1 year to the next. Clemens is at 61%, Bonds at 60.7%. You know, it's pretty much Every writer who votes for Clemens is voting for Bonds and vice versa, and none who vote, and you're either voting for both or you're not voting for either of them. And right now, it's about 6 in 10 voters are saying yes, and the other four are saying no. They are both in their eighth year of eligibility this year, so they get two more shots at it. Omar Vizquel took a big jump. He went up 9.8% from last year to this year, so he went from 42.8% to 52.6%. It's pretty strange why Vizquel is getting so much attention and more votes than Scott Rolen. He was at 52.6%, Rolen at 35.3%, and yet Rolen's wins above replacement of 70.2 is leaps and bounds higher than Vizquel's 45.6. Very strange. I mean, I like Omar Vizquel, and there's something to be said about voting in one of the two or three best defensive shortstops of all time. Anytime you're the best of something, you deserve consideration for the Hall of Fame. But it is interesting that his candidacy has way more support than Scott Rolen's at this stage, when you consider Scott Rolen was a far better player, as good a defensive player at his position, and a far superior offensive player. Billy Wagner should also probably be in the Hall of Fame. You wonder if he's going to get a surge at some point. He's at 31.7% of the vote. And I think guys like Gary Sheffield and Jeff Kent and Andrew Jones are Hall of Famers. Sheffield's at 30.5%. Kent got 27.5%. Andrew Jones at 19.5%. All three of those guys, I think, should be in the Hall of Fame at some point. They still have some time. All three of those guys do, but are still a long way away from the 75% mark. All right, real quick, before we finish things up here, Baseball America is out with their top 100, and only two Phillies prospects appear in Baseball America's top 100, but both, at least, are pretty high up there. They have Spencer Howard coming in at number 27, and Alec Bohm is right behind him at number 28. So you've got two guys there in the top 30 at number 27 and 28. Last year, Alec Bohm was ahead of Spencer Howard in prospect lists. This year, you're seeing Howard just ahead of Bohm in pretty much all of the prospect lists that have come out here this offseason. But what this also shows you is that there is a gap, and we've been talking about it, between the Phil's two top prospects and the rest of the farm system. And essentially, these guys are so close to the majors that the Phillies really have to look at these guys as major league assets, because both will probably be in the big leagues in 2020. There are some other players who could move up by midseason. Bryson Stott certainly has a chance if he hits well in Clearwater this year. Baseball America also had an alphabetical list of everyone who was on at least one top 150 rough draft. So all of the different writers who submitted a top 150 to become a part of the eventual top 100. Some of the names on those lists was Francisco Morales, who is a 6'5" pitcher who will be pitching in Lakewood to start the season. Bryson Stott and center fielder Johan Rojas, who will probably play in Clearwater to start the season. But no Adonis Medina, no Mickey Moniak, no Connor Siebold, No Luis Garcia, no Jojo Romero, no Jalen Ortiz. A lot of the guys that we hoped last year would make the leap did not make the leap last season. And so the Phillies prospects, there's some good names in there. Mickey Moniak is still super young. I think I saw he's still 2.5 years younger than when Rhys Hoskins first got called up. And so he's going to be in triple. He's going to be in AAA this year, and we'll see if Moniak can take another step forward in his development. It was really disappointing, Luis Garcia's offensive season last year. He came into 2019 as probably the hot prospect, the guy a lot of people expected to move up, and he just did not hit. He did not perform. He could not follow up a very intriguing 2018 season with a similar type season in 2019. It could be because the Phillies pushed him a little bit far. Maybe they did, but they believe in doing that, and we'll see if Garcia bounces back here in 2020. The guy I've always been really excited about is Jalen Ortiz. When they signed him for to a $4 million contract, he was a July 2nd pick out of the Dominican Republic. He had all kinds of raw power tools, but again, very, very raw. He's remained raw. He's a huge swing and miss guy. When he hits the ball, I mean, nobody hits it harder in the organization, but he's got way too much swing and miss. He can't put the bat on the baseball. And so a lot of these guys that we hoped were going to be taking steps forward last year didn't. And now we're hoping that some of these other guys that we're talking about, like Bryson Stott, the former first-round pick, he has a chance to really move up. I know Matt Winkelman of Phillies Minor Thoughts is really high on Johan Rojas in Clearwater, the center fielder who he says just has all kinds of upper body strength. But again, kind of like Ortiz, he's raw. But if he can put it together, he could really shoot up a lot of prospect lists and give the Phillies something. But right now, only two Phillies. There are only two Phillies top 100 prospects. Spencer Howard at number 27 and Alec Bohm coming in at number 28. All right, it's time to get to our stat of the week. And our good fight stat guru Schmenkman wrote an outstanding piece on the Phillies draft history that really everybody should read. I read it today. It's a really good overview of the Phillies drafts, the guys, the different scouting directors who led those drafts. And he had a cool stat in the piece that I wanted to throw out at you. The Phillies began retooling or rebuilding at basically the beginning of the 2012 trade deadline, because that's when they traded Hunter Pence and that's when they traded Shane Victorino. Since then, they've had seven drafts, 2013 to 2019. And of course, you can't really count the last two because those guys are still just getting started in their careers. But over those seven drafts, the Phillies have definitely had some success. Since 2013, those Phillies draft picks have produced 30 wins above replacement. Aaron Nola has been worth 17 wins above replacement, Rhys Hoskins 7, Kingery 3, J.P. Crawford 2, and all the others a combined 1. That's fourth highest in Major League Baseball over those seven draft classes. And even if we include 2012, they're still 8th in Big League Baseball in wins above replacement produced from those last 8 drafts. And Schmenkman says if we adjust for their higher draft positions over those years, they're 10th since 2012 and still 4th since 2013. So the Phillies have not drafted great, but they have had some successes in recent years. And of course, these last two drafts still need a couple years to see how they pan out. And, you know, with a guy like Mickey Moniak, who was drafted in 2016, there's still time for him to be a major league contributor at some point and bring those numbers up. And we'll see with Spencer Howard and Alec Bohm whether or not they can add to that wins above replacement total when they hopefully come up to the big league sometime here in 2020. Folks, that'll do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My profound thanks to Mike Petriello of MLB.com for coming on the podcast once again. Just a reminder to head on over to the Hittin' Season Patreon. It's at patreon.com/hittin'season. And again, check out that new podcast that Justin Clue and Chris Jones have put together for you there. Again, you got to sign up on the $5 a month tier to get access to it. You also, when we have mailbag episodes of the podcast, Patreon members get first crack. We answer all the Patreon mailbag questions on those podcasts. And so that's another great reason to sign up. Plus, me and Liz and Justin and others are giving you extra content there, some written content. We review baseball movies. Justin and Liz review bad baseball books. I do some video stuff on baseball cards. Lots of great stuff there if you haven't checked it out. It's at patreon.com/hittin'season. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.